Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is audio from a book launch held in New York City on December 6th, 2025, with the book being China Changes Everything, an anthology by social justice activists, journalists, and commentators. The event was sponsored by Friends of Socialist China. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
So I'm Margaret Kimberly, and I'm editor of Black Agenda Report, and I'm a very proud contributor to this anthology, China Changes Everything. My chapter is entitled, China Cannot Be Contained. The idea of that the U.S. can somehow contain China, quote unquote, is a constant in U.S. politics and speaks to notions of supremacy and is therefore a very dangerous idea in and of itself. But China's economic and technical prowess cannot be stopped. And here are some examples of what I wrote about in this chapter of the book. So in 2019, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is passed annually, and this was during the first Trump administration, barred government agencies from contracting with companies that use components from Huawei, the Chinese telecom giant. But the Department of Defense, yes, I know now the Department of War, but in any case, at the time, the Department of Defense requested an exemption on the grounds that Huawei was so firmly entrenched around the world that finding a replacement would be impossible. And the Biden administration enacted several bans, including sales of advanced computer chips to China. But of course, what happened? China innovated, created its own chips. And one of the results was the DeepSeek artificial intelligence platform, an open source rival of ChatGPT, created at a fraction of the cost. China excels in building the grid to power AI and now has an oversupply of electricity, while the U.S. struggles with an electrical grid, which is now taxed even further by the construction of data centers around the country. In the immediate wake of the DeepSeek creation, the Trump administration announces a tariff trade war against most of the world, and which featured tariffs of as much as 145% against China. But it was Trump who ended up backing down after China stopped purchasing agriculture products from the U.S., such as soybeans, which they can get from Brazil, or beef, which you can get from Australia. And most importantly, tried to restrict access to rare earth minerals. But recently, Trump and Xi Jinping met, and Trump lowered tariffs back to the 15%, which is what his administration started with. So much for containment. So we have one country producing clean energy because it meets the people's needs, while another promotes fossil fuels because the fossil fuel industry dictates policy. So we see capitalism controlling the United States, but the country emerging as the preeminent economy has done so because it's socialist and makes decisions based on meeting the needs of the people and thus cannot be contained. Now, I've been fortunate enough to visit China recently, and it was great to be on China's high-speed rail system. About not enough can be said, but it's very funny to me, 25,000 miles, I believe it is, of high-speed rail. And recently, Amtrak announced we've got high-speed rail between Washington and Boston, and they can reach speeds of 160 miles an hour. But the tracks on the route have not been upgraded. They will rarely reach this top speed, which is already low in comparison to China. And the train I was on reached a speed of 186 miles per hour. And why is this? Why does the U.S. lag? The U.S. now spends about $900 billion on defense, on the military, that is to say on the corporations that make up the military-industrial complex. And that one fact alone explains so much about why we don't have the infrastructure that people in China can take for granted. But the U.S. won't take no for an answer. No sooner had Trump been slapped down after his meeting with Xi Jinping that his administration instigated a conflict between China and Japan, whose new prime minister followed Washington's orders, as vassals will do, and made very troubling, threatening comments about Taiwan. China reacted, reminding Japan about their relationship, and took action on trade and transportation and other issues. But this episode shows that military advantage is all that the U.S. has left. It has proxies in Japan or the Philippines or other countries in that region and uses them to antagonize China. But that's all the U.S. has, brute force, which is why the U.S. is the nation that has to be contained. So we see a country that spends money on infrastructure for the public good that is prospering. But meeting human needs is never part of the equation in the U.S., not for the capitalists or politicians who are their errand boys and errand girls. It's socialism which provides so many benefits. And the sooner we in the United States, I think I'm preaching to the choir, I'm sure you all know this, but the sooner people in the U.S. know this, the better off we will be and the world will be. Thank you all so much. And our next speaker is our co-chair, Sarah Flounders, and our host for the day, Sarah Flounders.
Well, thank you so much, Margaret. We're very excited about this new book, and it's been almost a year, really, from conception and gathering to today. Now, China is making monumental leaps, a game changer, they call it, on a world scale, as you'll hear tonight from many of the authors. But let's remember that China is formerly a colonized country, invaded, looted, reduced by the imperialist countries into the poorest, least developed country in the world. China's accomplishments are possible based on a unique ownership and decision-making process. It's who decides and in whose interests are decisions made. That's the real issue. And so my opening chapter in China Changes Everything deals with the way in which decision-making on a grand scale happens in China. China is more in tune, as it turns out, with the needs of modern technology and industry today in a global economy. And how is this possible? It didn't start out that way. But there's a fundamental class and property difference between People's China and U.S. imperialism that U.S. was once so powerful and is now an archaic, dying system incapable of solving the problems of the modern world or of a global economy. It's that difference in class ownership. It impacts modernization and the ability to adapt to new technology. In the United States, nearly all resources are privately owned by a handful of billionaires. And that's true even public forests and waters, all minerals that are ripe for exploitation are for private property of billionaires. In China, it's the revolution that changed everything. Now, the overwhelming bulk of resources, and that's true for oil and gas and coal and gold and gems and raw earth minerals and water and land, they're socially owned and used for the development of the whole society. It also means high-speed railroads and airlines and energy and communication, and most important, the banks. All privately owned here, but in China, the banks, nationally owned, play a crucial role in subsidizing and developing key industries. Those key areas of the economy are all state-owned enterprises, SOEs, as they call them. And it's a state controlled by the working class. A state controlled by a massive Communist Party. The Communist Party of China has more than 100 million members. Its cells, elected from the ranks, are in every workplace, in every neighborhood, school, and department. This party organization is really committed to defending socialist property, and it's determined to protect China's sovereignty, They're the backbone of the extensive social programs. In the U.S. and in the West as a whole, the major capitalist corporations are only capable of ruthlessly competing with each other. Capitalism is based on expand or die, and that means constant growth or devastating failure. Ruthless competition for profit is a fundamental feature of capitalism. Its all-pervasive competition disrupts cooperative work that's needed to solve the enormous environmental and social problems that confront the whole planet today. Now, when you think about it, why is this? It really is at a higher stage of industrial and technical development in a more complex global society actually requires a higher stage of social organization. One flows from the other. Under capitalism, there's little or no collective planning. Disruptive changes from one U.S. administration to another, one change in CEO, one merger decision, it disrupts the ability to solve the overarching problems that humanity faces on a global scale. So socially owned, socially planned production, it doesn't need to compete in order to survive. It's able to plan in advance in an organized way. Now, just for example, higher levels of production need high-tech infrastructure to move what's produced to global markets. And I want to give a really fundamental change. Under capitalism, the entire military industry is privately owned for profit. It's an enormous incentive for endless war. War is profitable to multi-billionaires. It doesn't matter if it's a disaster for the targeted country, for millions of civilians, and even for long-term U.S. policy. The immediate wars are profitable. The Department of Defense, now Department of War, is publicly funded with tax dollars, our tax dollars, to build those endless weapon systems, jet bombers, nuclear submarines, and mercenary contractors. It's all paid our tax dollars, but it generates billions in private property. It's all based on which corporations get the contracts. So it's a huge drain on the economy. The military budget is now $1 trillion a year. As Trump said, never seen anything like it. And they're proud of it. So war is very profitable, but it doesn't solve any of the needs for society. In fact, and I'll go back to this again and again, and every chapter does, a higher stage of industrial and technical development in a more complex society actually requires a higher stage of social organization. The most important aspect in defending China today is recognizing the socialist base of the Chinese economy and the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party in building an economy and a society of a new type. It's not a finished product. China explains that they are building towards socialism, that they're in the primary stage of socialism, that they're not yet a fully developed socialist country with equality for all. They call it socialism with Chinese characteristics. It's also described as market socialism. There's a market, but it's built on socialist pillars. Its central planning remains decisive. So in conclusion, I'll say that socialist economies based on planning and on cooperation are capable of solving many problems. And with this in mind, stepping up the defense of China, its revolution and its accomplishments is necessary for the collective future of humanity. We are next going to pass this mic to Sydney Loving, and Sydney's chapter is Reflection on How China is Building Socialism. So let me pass this to Sydney.
Oh, it's great to be here. My chapter was obviously inspired by the trip that we went to when we visited five cities. You saw all kinds of things, but everything really affirmed that China is continuing to build socialism in a way that centers the people, which isn't that the point of socialism in the first place. Yeah. It is. I have visited, you know, almost 20 different cities and giving kind of report backs on the trip and talking about China. It's been to a lot of different types of audiences, not all, you know, leftist audiences. Many people have never heard a positive thing about China in their lives. But things are changing. You can't hide the truth forever. So, you know, just to say a few points about my chapter, what I'm really doing is kind of comparing and contrasting. We got to see what life is like there. And we know what it's like to live in a declining imperialist superpower. People here are being actually dragged backwards in so many different ways. In China, you know, they're advancing, you know, developing the productive forces, you know, these kind of industrial revolutions that put them at the forefront of these new technologies, which is good because we know which class is in charge of them over here and what their motivations are. But yeah, you have the construction of a socialist society, and we can go there and see it for ourselves. You don't have blocks and blocks of tents, people on the street in the freezing cold. You have part of the social welfare, a big focus of the party is a housing policy that is, we were just talking about this, it's at the same time so wide-ranging, but also so detailed and specifically tailored to the needs and wants of different sectors and different national minorities, people who live different lives. And the reason for that is that dignified housing is considered something that has to be guaranteed. This is part of the world historical project of lifting 800 million people out of extreme poverty. And that's indicative of a system that serves the people. That's serve the people is real. In this country, to the extent that there's development in certain sectors, it's for the few. The many are left behind. In China, development that leaves people behind is not an option. That's considered a failure. So there's two visions for the future. The powers that be in this country, their vision is more division, more war, greed. But what's happening in China and their relationship to the rest of the world also really proves that the future for everybody is actually more equal, and there's more justice in it, and there's more peace in it. You know, China's showing the way. It's a real place. It's not a utopia, as they said. But, you know, Mao said only socialism can save China. And, you know, if you'll allow me to extrapolate, I think only socialism can save the United States. So, yeah, just want to thank everyone who made the book possible. Sarah Flounders, the editors. It's so important to keep telling. Like I said, I've talked to a lot of different people. They have all kinds of questions. Well, this sounds great, but you're not allowed to criticize the government over there. Someone who said that, this was in Florida. This was the same town where, you know, our comrades had just been arrested on a college campus for speaking out against administration. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, but people don't know. And we have to keep, you know, telling the truth, shining a light on these things. And that's what this book is all about. What this book is a part of is creating creating and fortifying a stream of information to, you know, Western audiences so that when the war drums start beating, people can actually understand that you're being lied to. China is showing the way to the future, and the future is bright. So thank you again, everyone.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is audio from a book launch held in New York City on December 6th, 2025, with the book being China Changes Everything, an anthology by social justice activists, journalists, and commentators.
Our next speaker is Mick Kelly, political secretary of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, and he's the author of the chapter entitled An Analysis of the Escalating U.S. Threats Towards China. Mick, thank you.
Thank you. Let me cover the main points that were in the chapter of the book I wrote. Basically, I'd like to talk about five different things. And I was addressing the whole issue of the escalating U.S. war threats towards China. I read bourgeois foreign policy journals. I can't help myself. I look at them all the time. And what do they debate? They debate things like how long or how short will a war with China be? What kind of weapons system should be used? Should the U.S. modernize its nuclear weapons? It goes on and on and on and on. And if U.S. war planners are taking this seriously, I think those of us who wish to build the peace movement need to take it very seriously, too. So if we look at stuff like, or things like, the issue of context, which I think is extremely important, I think two things stand out. One is the U.S. is a declining empire, and that decline has been accelerating. And just to pull out a few numbers around it, in 1950, the U.S. had about half the world GDP. At this point, it has about half of that, at about 23-24%, something like that. If you look at basic production indexes, U.S. versus China, you will find things like China has about 163 times the shipbuilding capacity as the United States. You will find things like in a couple of months, or actually a single month period, China expands its capacity to produce electricity at the rate that often takes the United States 2 years. The United States is in a period of decay and decline, while China is going through a peaceful rise and is essentially ascendant. And that's a very important thing in terms of shaping the world today. And as we all know, where economic power lies, so will political and military power. And that's a lot, again, of what's the stage that we're working on in this period. So looking at U.S. foreign policy, we see a couple of things that are genuinely important. In the economic sphere, the United States is trying to decouple or de-link the U.S. economy from China. Two, there's the whole tariff regime that is taking place. It was mentioned earlier, about up to 143%. It's actually substantially below that. But the point is, you see this decoupling and de-linking. And I think perhaps most importantly, you see the U.S. retreating and withdrawing from institutions of global governance such as the WTO. And I think that's kind of a vital thing. I think some of us, actually, I know quite a few of you here, we were old enough to be fighting the World Trade Organization back in 1999. And many of us were arrested in those demonstrations, and they were actually quite dramatic, particularly the ones in Seattle. At this point, it is the U.S. government that is dismantling the World Trade Organization by refusing to appoint people to the adjudication, to the mechanisms that actually judge disputes. So you see the whole thing of the WTO actually trying to stop. But to pick another example, in Washington, D.C., they're talking about having the U.S. withdraw from the International Monetary Fund. By the way, the U.S. is the only country that has actual veto power over what the fund does, but nonetheless, it is an actual discussion that's taking place in Washington, D.C. As the U.S., again, the empire shrinks and it withdraws from multilateral institutions. And what's replacing that, in fact, is an attempt to use military power to mask economic weakness. Military power to mask economic weakness. So in the budget that's being proposed for this upcoming year, 2026, we find money for a massive military buildup that's aimed at China. And this is absolutely true, and it's absolutely real, and we absolutely have to take it seriously. And the war planners at the Pentagon, what they are trying to do is, number one, contain China, but number two, stop China from achieving a very important national goal that is vital for its rejuvenation, and that is the liberation and reunification with Taiwan. Taiwan province is a part of China, absolutely a part. In 1662, I think it was, the Chinese were able to throw out the Dutch colonialists who set themselves down on Taiwan. China and Taiwan is the same place, the same country. And the liberation of Taiwan from basically from separatists and their U.S. backers is something that is not going to be off the agenda forever. In fact, it's on the agenda. The clock is ticking. And the U.S. would do well to stay out of an important historical process. And I think this is actually a vital point to understand. China's cause in Taiwan is a just cause and it deserves the support of all progressive people. So by way of a conclusion, China wants peace and progress, and I think China shows that all the time. For example, let's just pick a particular place, and that is Gaza, where China is talking about committing massive amounts of money, I believe it's $100 million, for the rehabilitation of Gaza. What does the U.S. do there? It sponsors a genocide. That is the tale of compare and contrast, the tale of two cities, two places, and two futures. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mick Kelly. We next have Chae-Yoon Park, who is an organizer with No Do Toll for Korean Community Development. And Chae-Yoon's chapter is Lips and Teeth, Korea, China, and Northeast Asia's Long Revolution. So, Chae-Yoon Park.
My chapter, Lips and Teeth, Korea, China, and Northeast Asia's Long Revolution, concerns really the history of the Korean Revolution and the Chinese Revolution, which I argue need to be looked at as a conjoined process. Part of the core of what I'm saying in this chapter is that Korea and China, you know, there is this expression that emerged from the Korean War, the phrase lips and teeth, which is drawn from a Chinese proverb that, you know, without the lips, the teeth will be cold. And that's to articulate the historical relationship between China and Korea as revolutionary processes, as nations that arose their own independent but also conjoined and interrelated historical development. And I think it's something that's very important to understand for anyone that has an interest in China, that if you want to learn more about China, China's relations with the world, with the region, with the US, you should also pay attention to Korea. And if you have an interest in Korea but you're not paying attention to China, that's very foolish and you should correct that immediately. Now, I think some things I want to highlight with regard to what I think we can learn in examining Korea in relation to China are three things in the present moment. One is the reality of continued imperialist aggression in the Western Pacific. The second is the economic decay that is metastasizing within the imperialist bloc. And lastly, how small nations in the global periphery can leverage the shifting tides of global currents in order to advance their development and establish themselves as sovereign powers. In other words, how can the global South actually, you know, put some reins on the Chinese century and ascend in their own development as well? And I just want to highlight some key information. The U.S. National Security Strategy was just released a couple of days ago. There is a lot of chatter about the fact that the administration's rhetoric against China has softened. Now, that's true, but I think one thing that we have learned at No Do Toll is that we don't pay attention to what the U.S. says. We pay attention to what they do. And what they are doing is that they are maintaining the level of belligerence in East Asia that they had before. And they are maintaining and, in fact, accelerating the rate at which it becomes even more belligerent. To just give an example of this, in 2023, the U.S. conducted 200 days of war games in Korea. In 2024, it was 275. This year, it's expected to exceed that record once again. So we are now in a place where almost on a daily basis, the U.S. is conducting war maneuvers in Korea. Now, those are officially targeting the DPRK. They are exercises mainly that concern the interoperability and the use of warfare in a specific geographic terrain. But war is war. And, you know, training is training. And these things can be adapted to other places as well. So I think that's something we need to understand. The second point, the decay within the imperialist bloc, I think, is a kind of building on what Mick Kelly was explaining to us earlier, particularly concerning the tariff regime. What I would argue is that the U.S. is now in a place where its imperialist influence is shrinking, and in order to shore up its own particular strength, it's going to essentially cannibalize its allies, and we're seeing this happen through the tariff process. In Korea, this is especially sharp because South Korea as a country, although often, you know, vaunted as one of the world's leading capitalist economies, is actually quite different when you look at the numbers in comparison to, say, the EU or Japan. It plays a different role in the world system. Its economy is not nearly as large as these countries. And yet the US administration has now secured a total of $678 billion in investments and private deals flowing from essentially Korean taxpayers and workers into the pockets of Wall Street. So I think, you know, that is a dynamic that is only going to continue to develop. It's going to continue to affect other countries that are in essentially the U.S.-dominated bloc. And I think it's going to lead to the emergence of very sharp class contradictions within the imperialist alliances. Lastly, I want to get into my last point. How can small nations actually take advantage of the so-called Chinese century? I think that China's rise has generated a lot of hopes and also generated some frustrations. And you know, this mainly depends on what people believe China should or should not be doing in the world system. My point isn't today to comment on what I think that should be, because that's actually not my business. But what I can tell you about is how the DPRK has been leveraging these changes. If you paid close attention to the 80th anniversary celebrations of the World Anti-Fascist War in Beijing just a few months ago, you would have noted that three world leaders were at the head of that celebration. It was Xi Jinping, it was Vladimir Putin of Russia, and it was Kim Jong-un of the DPRK. And I think this is actually very noteworthy because Russia and China are behemoths. They're massive civilizations that are recognized throughout the world. The DPRK has 25 million people. So why is it that this country now stands among these giants? And what I would argue is that it is helping to reshape the world system as an independent power in its own right. And I think taking the time to understand this is very important. And I think what we are beginning to see emerge in Korea is a tale of two separate paths. One system, which is thoroughly chained to the US, is more or less looking like it might go down with the ship over time. The other is hitching the changing tides in the world system and actually able to leverage those for its own development. The DPRK is about to finish a massive national housing revitalization project. There are more and more photos and videos emerging from the country every single day that demonstrate that things like smartphone technology have become widespread, that demonstrate that its economy is actually in a place where it is very, well, not only rapidly recovering from where it once was, but in fact developing and in some key ways maybe moving ahead of many other countries of similar size. And I think, you know, with the coming years, we'll only begin to see this change in fortune shift. But at the same time, Korea will remain a very important flashpoint in the Western Pacific and a place where it's very likely that the story of these confrontations between one declining system and one rising system will really be brought out. So thank you.
Our next speaker is Sue Harris. She's a videographer from the People's Video Network, and her chapter is Healthcare in China, a Cooperative Project. Sue Harris.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be a part of this because I think it's an important book and an important idea that has to spread. And I hope I can contribute something to it. As was said, this is on healthcare in China, which is a cooperative project. And it's really something that's already been mentioned in the notion that cooperation really is the winner. China's figured out how to cooperate on a global basis, and that's the key to its success in healthcare and pretty much every other area of life. On an individual level, if you're working towards a goal with other people that is cooperating, it's important to understand the task and the people you're working with, what they need and what they have to offer, how to work with them to reach the goal. That way, everybody gets what they want in the most efficient way. Everybody wins. Well, it's the opposite in the Western capitalist orientation, where the goal is always business deals that are for the purpose of making a profit over the people you're working with, not letting them in on all your motives, figuring out how to exploit them, get more than you give. I use the example of Chinese healthcare to illustrate my point. As I say in my article, the healthcare system in China is not considered a business. The goal is not profit as it is in the West. Healthcare is about saving lives and preventing illness. I tell about how the Chinese related to the COVID epidemic, the COVID pandemic. How, as a society, they immediately went into lockdown together, cooperating to keep social distance, while at the same time, local community organizations were tracking vulnerable people who needed attention how they bonded with Cuba to develop vaccines that worked and then gave the surplus medications away in millions of doses to countries of the global South who had been, of course, excluded from the business deals of big pharma in the West. In this way, China not only emerged from the pandemic with fewer deaths and at less cost, but they helped the world to do so as well. China exhibited true internationalism at a time when it was most needed. And it's this internationalism that may provide the key for human survival or even human progress in the future.
Janet Mays is the web manager of iacenter.org, and that is true for about 25 years. That's a long time.
My topic is the race for moondust, U.S. imperialism versus China. There's much fanfare, this is from the chapter, surrounding the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which is NASA, Artemis 3 project, which boasts that it will land the first woman and the first person of color on the moon within the next 2 years. The mission depends on the success of centibillionaire Elon Musk's super rocket, the SpaceX Starship, designed to ferry our astronauts from lunar orbit to the moon's surface. In 2021, SpaceX won a $2.89 billion contract with NASA to develop the super rocket. So far, its performance has been lacking. In 2023, the rocket's unsuccessful explosive launch spewed brown grime and dust onto populated areas in Texas' Boca Chica area, which Musk calls, quote, a wasteland. The blasts are destroying the fragile surrounding ecostructure replete with endangered species. In March of 2025, their super rocket again exploded, spewing debris on the Bahamas and temporarily grounding flights at Florida's airports. Several months later, Starship finally achieved a largely successful test flight, but Artemis 3 is still behind schedule, now expected to launch no earlier than 2028. The China National Space Administration, meanwhile, has already successfully tested a lunar landing. They're way ahead of us. What is this really all about? The United States is hell-bent on building mining stations on the moon before China does because of another kind of dust, moon dust, replete with helium-3, touted to be the fuel for an emerging technology that will provide clean, abundant energy. In 2021, Beijing's Research Institute of Uranium Geology announced that China's lunar Chang'e 5 mission had identified this precious mineral on the moon. Helium-3 fusion technology promises to produce clean energy, nuclear energy without radioactive waste, imagine. Fossil fuel and even current nuclear power plant technology would become completely obsolete. Staff workers with the return capsule of Chang'e 5 probe on December 17, 2020, that's the picture of them celebrating, the lander unfurled the first Chinese flag on the moon, and they brought back helium-3. The Hills analysis describes the crystal mineral sample returned by the Chang'e probe as exceedingly tiny, about one-tenth the size of a human hair. The helium-3 that it contains has the potential to change the world. Three space missions bringing back helium-3 rich moon dust would provide the entire planet with energy for a year. That's from China Daily. One cargo payload, about 25 tons on a space shuttle, would power the entire United States for a year, representing a value, and this is why the United States is so interested in it, of about $3 billion a ton. The Hill wrote, "The country that corners the moon mining market of helium-3 will control, in essence, the Earth. The moon could become the Persian Gulf of the mid to late 21st century. Clean and abundant fusion energy would change the world in a way that can barely be evaluated. China, along with Russia, plans to complete construction of a lunar base by 2035. Then it will mine helium-3 rich crystal, chainsite Y, which is contained in vast quantities on the moon's regolith, which is the layer of unconsolidated rocky material covering the bedrock." It's all over the place. Since China has accelerated plans for lunar exploration and future mining, the panicked imperialist countries, particularly the U.S., cannot sit by and just watch. They are horrified at the possibility that China could be the first country to gather the moon dust that contains helium-3. If they lose this space race, imperialist governments and corporations will lose the opportunity to corner the multi-billion dollar market for this potentially planet-saving technology and sell it for a profit. The ultimate value, of course, is mammoth profit for the U.S., its imperialist allies, and its private companies if they control the mining, transporting, and fusion process of helium-3. Given the fragile condition of Western economics, it's a space race the imperialists cannot afford to lose. If our planet is to survive the climate disaster, it is imperative that the imperialists lose the race to the moon. Far from seeking to profit, China's approach to international energy production is in fact geared towards protecting the planet.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is audio from a book launch held in New York City on December 6th, 2025, with the book being China Changes Everything, an anthology by social justice activists, journalists, and commentators.
Our next speaker is Gregory Dunkel, who is a contributing editor to Workers World, and his chapter is entitled "Around the World, China is Turning on the Lights." Greg Dunkel.
What impelled me to write the chapter I wrote on China Turns on the Light is that Chad, a small, very poor country that most of the people in this room could not place it on a map, but it accepts more refugees than the United States does. It grants more asylum claims than the United States does for like the past 3 or 4 years. And this is a country where 6% of the people, just 6% of the people, have access to electricity. When the sun goes down, they have to live in the dark. Candles, kerosene lamps, wood stoves. The predominant energy resource that this country has is firewood. It's a very poor country. Now, what's happened is that when the United States imposed these tariffs on Chinese goods, it meant that the solar panel, the solar photovoltaic industry in China had lost a big market. But then it said, what could it do to turn the lights on? What could it do to sell, to distribute its products? And it turned to Africa. And Africa imports of Chinese solar panels, broadly speaking, has tripled in 2024. And the country of Chad now has 60% of its imports of Chinese photovoltaic products. Once that's installed, it's going to allow Chad, this extremely poor country, to turn the lights on. They expect to reach 30% of the people in Chad having access to electricity by the year 2030, which is 10 years before they thought they were going to be able to do it. China has turned the lights on. It's used its excess production capabilities that have so admirably been described by speakers before me to do good for Africa, to help poor African countries. And it also means that they can produce their profits in China. They're making money on these products that they're selling for far less than the United States. So 80% of the world's production of photovoltaic solar panels is done in China. And China is on the way to create a well-lit 21st century. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Michael Kramer, who is co-coordinator of Veterans for Peace China Working Group, and his chapter is entitled 200 Plus Years of U.S. Military Deployments in and Around China.
Okay, thank you all for coming tonight. So my chapter is actually a chronology of U.S. military deployments in China, beginning in 1820 and actually continuing on to today, but actually within China, ending in 1949. The chronology was originally prepared for a Veterans for Peace China Working Group workshop in 2020 at the Veterans for Peace National Convention. And it was also illustrated with photos from the time. Unfortunately, we couldn't include them in the book. But more recently, we talk about the occupation of Palestine and particularly Gaza. And these occupations are searing. The peoples who are occupied, even after the occupation ends, never forget the occupation. The occupation of China by the U.S. military was brutal in many ways. It was not a velvet glove. It was an iron fist. And I would just like to mention pick out a few dates so you get kind of the impact. May 16th, 1820, the 38-gun, wooden-hulled, three-masted, heavy frigate USS Congress, with a crew of 340, docks unannounced and uninvited in Guangzhou on the Pearl River. So these deployments go back not only decades, but centuries. And February 24th, 1927, the 4th Marine Regiment, commanded by Brigadier General Smedley Butler, arrives from San Diego aboard the USS Shomon. The ship docks at the Standard Oil Company terminal in Shanghai. U.S. military forces in China now, this is 1927, total 6,000 troops and 44 naval vessels in Chinese waters. Smedley Butler later had an epiphany and switched sides and wrote a book called War is a Racket, where he really denounced imperialism and described himself as a gangster for the boys on Wall Street. But he did say that in China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. And this went on for 4 decades. I'm just going to go back on one. January 18th, 1912, less than 3 weeks after the Republic of China is established, the U.S. Army 15th Infantry Regiment deploys to Tientsin. The 15th Infantry Regiment does not leave China until March 2nd, 1938. Now, the U.S. military at the time, this was a Jim Crow army, racist to the core. This was not sort of the army maybe of our grandparents during World War II when there were a lot of conscripts and, you know, folks in the unions. With all its contradictions, this was led by a core usually from the South, and was very brutal in its interactions with the Chinese people. But it all ended, but in some ways it does continue. We upgraded the chronology to include current situation. These deployments are not over the international border of China, but they do border China, from U.S. Navy with provocative maneuvers in the Taiwan Straits. These are very dangerous. These are, one of the members of our chapter actually was an officer aboard a destroyer that did one of these provocative maneuvers. And they're very hair trigger. You know, one person shoots, another person shoots, and it could be a total conflagration. So very dangerous things. They operate out of Yokosuka, Japan. This is the 7th Fleet. And there are spy flights that continue from Kadima Air Base in Okinawa. So hope that the chronology is a contribution. We know that the current situation didn't begin today. It began in 1820.
Our final speaker is Dee Knight, who is on the Advisory Council of the Friends of Socialist China. He's the author of several other books, but his chapter is "The Leadership Was Key in China's Targeted Poverty Alleviation Campaign." So thank you, and Dee, on your chapter.
Thank you very much. I learned about China's amazing targeted poverty alleviation campaign from close-up in-person visits in 2024 and 2025. While in China's super-isolated, poor southwestern province of Guizhou, I met two brilliant, hard-working women comrades who played key roles. One was a volunteer party secretary at village level who told me how she moved from her comfortable job as a foreign policy functionary in the provincial capital to live with poor villagers and help build the skills and knowledge to transform their lives. And the other was a professor at the party cadre school in Guizhou who gave us a detailed seminar on the strategy and methods of the targeted poverty alleviation program. It was amazing. They made it clear that this campaign was top priority for the Chinese party leadership from 2012 to 2020, involving literally hundreds of thousands of comrades who went to live in isolated, poverty-stricken mountain villages. I was privileged to visit several of these villages and also saw firsthand the amazing tunnels, highways, and gigantic bridges that were built to span those mountains in this 90% mountainous province during the same years of the poverty alleviation campaign. We have 18 bridges here in New York. They're all super low and you can walk across them. The bridges in Guizhou are literally the highest in the world. It's incredible. We were invited to go up on one of them and I was chicken. I couldn't go, you know. I have bad knees and acrophobia, so I watched from below, and I toured the Bridge Museum there. This story became a chapter in my own book, Befriending China, but for China Changes Everything, I deepened it and showed how it led to development of whole new layers of leadership among the villagers themselves, as they could connect to the rest of China and take control of their lives and futures. That was the amazing thing. I was also able to benefit from the work of Ting Chuck of the Transcontinental Institute for Social Research, author of Serve the People, The Eradication of Extreme Poverty in China. Her study documented the numbers of people involved and the campaign's impact, which was genuinely transformative for nearly half of China's gigantic population. It was a lesson in what socialism means, especially in China, where common prosperity is now a living reality for everyone. Thank you very much.
Well, for everyone here, you've just heard 12 of the chapters. There are 34 in this book. The most interesting thing about little vignettes is you get different people's takes on the contributions they see in China. Very, very different. Now, this is a period when U.S. says it's going to go to war against Venezuela over drugs. They're going to stop drugs.
Yeah.
We should never forget the opium wars in China and what the U.S. and the British called freedom of navigation. Freedom of navigation was the right to sell opium, the right to sell drugs, to addict millions and millions of people in China. The U.S. and British fought wars, decimated cities, blew up warehouses, burned the Summer Palace. You could go one after the other over the right to sell drugs in China. So today, they claim they're going to go to war against Venezuela. That is the next target, absolutely. And going to declare no-fly zones. And we stand in solidarity today with Palestine, with Venezuela, with China, with every country that is targeted by U.S. imperialism all around the world, because they're fighting for the same thing in terms of sovereignty, self-determination, peace, and development.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was audio from a book launch held in New York City on December 6th, 2025, with the book being China Changes Everything, an anthology by social justice activists, journalists, and commentators. The event was sponsored by Friends of Socialist China. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.